We're back with our first Mindful News podcast for 2021. Now, this is quite a special one for me, as my guest today, Sean Carroll, is someone I've known for about 13 years. I'd make regular visits to Milwaukee for work, and Sean was bartending at the local watering hole, Moe's Irish Pub. Now, over the years, his friendship grew, and out of nowhere, he joined the software company I was working for, and soon became my boss. I've been lucky enough to have great bosses, and Sean is right up there with the best. The magic of this friendship really took hold as I introduced Sean to mindfulness. He'd reached out to me following some personal challenges, dealing with anger, frustration, and relationships. He didn't know much about mindfulness, but he knew he wanted to give it a go. Cut to almost a year later, his mindfulness practice is going strong, and he's closer to his family and more present to them than he's ever been. The transformation is quite remarkable and a great testament to the benefits of mindfulness. We also talk about his 15 years of previous software experience, the early loss of his parents, dealing with death and mental illness. We also talk about the lessons of being a bartender, and we dig into the multiple benefits that he now enjoys from mindfulness. So this is something that I've been wanting to do for a while. Having conversations is something that we do regularly.
We do.
And the best conversations are usually the ones where it's introspective, where it's, you know, about stuff that you've recently learned or that you're struggling with, but, you know, making progress at the same time about life, about happiness, etc. So that's kind of what sprang the idea of having this conversation. But in fact, our friendship goes back quite a ways away.
Yes, it does.
When I first really was getting to know you, you were a very friendly face at an Irish bar in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. I would go there regularly, a couple of times a year for work. And then quite incredibly, you know, several years later, you came to work for the same company that I was mm-hmm. working in, right? Mm-hmm. So you go from, you know, the bartender and, you know, a friendly face at Moe's to a colleague. So that was really awesome when that happened. Mm-hmm. And then to working in the same team, and then, you know, to eventually, you know, managing the team now. Mm-hmm. Within that incredible relationship, there was, you know, the conversation of mindfulness, and, you know, we started practicing that a bit together. You took to it so well, and that really took that friendship to another level, because it was really something, you know, very profound there. So, you know, so thanks for jumping on this podcast. You know, I've set a bit of background.
It's funny, when I was a bartender at a really interesting time in my life, and it was the confluence of a time when Jason Cotterill, who's a mutual friend of ours, was also divorced, and I had just recently divorced, and I had never planned on being a bartender in my life. And the guy that owned the place, you know, said, "Hey, I know you're coming on some hard times," and he, Johnny V, said, you know, you should consider being a bartender, because he knew me and he knew that I'd fallen on hard times. My business had failed and marriage had failed and all that stuff. And, you know, that was many years ago, and 13 years ago. So I joined, I agreed to do this, and I learned, you know, quickly that I was good at it. I mean, I enjoyed it. I don't know if I was good at it. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed yeah. meeting the people. And I enjoyed entertaining the crowds, and most of the people that work on a daily and regular basis was PK Ware, coming across the street from their offices and, you know, just directly across the street from the pub. And then, so my earliest memories of you, was there was always a buzz about, you know, you go from the regular guys coming into PK Ware every day for a couple mm-hmm. drinks, talking about their day, to this expanded crowd of people who not only looked different, but also had, you know, different accents and, you know, different looks about them. And so it just grew from there. And my earliest, most profound memory was, well, first of all, whenever you guys would come over, you know, it was like, all we could sell you is Miller Lights. There wasn't enough Miller Light in the place, because I don't know what it was about the lager beers and the Europeans and the people that came over, but they loved it. And so, you know, you kind of, you know, you put two and two together, well, that's key. But somehow, some way, we ended up, because I eventually moved across the street to the steakhouse, and we ended up moving. I ended up moving there, and there would be kind of this crowd that would go to the steakhouse, which we called Clean Moe's, and the crowd that stayed at the pub, which was Dirty Moe's. And you were one of the few people that traversed both worlds very yeah. easily, I might add. Mm-hmm. And you know, so my earliest memories was that was kind of when it was established. But then when you came across the steakhouse and asked to sit down late night at the piano, it was a grand piano there, and just played away. And I thought, God, you know, Guy's got it all. I mean, he comes over here, he just can, you know, fits in with everybody. And then he starts just, you know, playing away and tickling the ivories. And it was just so great. So,
but genuinely for me, there is a 4 or 5 year period where it was that Cheers experience. You know, you go in there and see who sat around the bar and who's waiting today, and seeing you there, it was, you know, oh, hey, Guy, you know, mm-hmm. Miller Lite, you know, the usual, yeah. You know.
Well, it was by design. I have to say, I give a lot of credit to Johnny V, the guy that owns Moe's to this day. It was really about creating, you know, personal experiences to make the experience made more sense and made more of a long-term customer and guest than you would just having good food or cold beer. Mm. Right. And so there was a purposeful intent to get to know people by their name. Mm. And, you know, a myriad of lessons that I learned. I wish in some ways it probably wasn't the right time in my life, because I was probably too, you know, thinking I was going to, you know, take over the world, that I would have ever, you know, slumped to be a bartender. I'm, you know, college graduate, going to, you know, be a big time guy. Yeah. But, you know, so in a way it's taught me more lessons about people and about life than any other job I've ever had. And I use the practices, you know, of what I've learned, even at PKWare. So I would love for my story to be that I was a bartender that became a software salesperson, you know, and managing the accounts of PKWare. But I did have 15 years of exactly. software and IT experience too. It would be a better story. This bartender just seemed like he'd be really a good sales guy. So we hired him. And, you know, we, you and I in the last 5 years have had a ton of success together, ups, downs and everything in between, people coming and going, some people that have, you know, really made a mark on both of us and had a great impact on both of us. So, you know, I look at that in the longevity of things, and that's a great thing about, you know, having time, you know, to kind of look back and say, wow, you know, this has been really fruitful, and mm-hmm. and to see that you know, we've grown and we've been through a lot, and as coworkers, but also starting out as friends early on. So I'm yeah. grateful for that time.
And you knew over the years that Guy has something to do with mindfulness, or, you know, there was some mindfulness talk, and then at one point you reached out to me and say, hey, do you have some time? Can we talk a little bit about this? And I was coming over to Milwaukee to, you know, for the winter party and, you know, the winter kickoff. That's and right. I said, you know, let's go to your hotel room and let's, you know, let's take an hour. And instead of just like talking about it, let me guide you through a meditation. And we went over of the basics.
Yeah, it was funny. It's almost a year. It would be a year in January. And also not, you know, not dissimilar in the sense that it was a real pivotal, you know, time in terms of sort of transition for me. And I was really struggling, maybe for the first time ever, even the first time I kind of went through some hardships, I kind of got through it because I was pretty young, but this time I just didn't see it happening and evolving like it did. So I was really kind of troubled and trying to get out of my head and struggling to kind of get my mind right and kind of focusing on things without sort of getting overwhelmed by the emotions and thoughts and things that were in my head. So I did reach out because I had heard about mindfulness probably through conversations around Todd and his son and then our conversations with Jason, but yeah. I never asked you about it.
And shout then out I asked to Todd, who's who was actually, you know, when we think of my memory, early memories of you, you know, he played yeah. a massive role in that. So shout out to him.
Amazing guy, brilliant guy, and really fun to be around. He's the kind of guy like you, Guy, that you could spend 2-3 hours and you're like, has it been 2 or 3 hours? It seems like we've only been here doing this 30 minutes, you know, yeah. and you know, that's the kind of fun you can have with people like you and Todd and others, but a very, very profoundly impactful person on both of our lives. So, but what's interesting about that is that I asked you and I tell this story, not to too many people, but you know, how often do you get invited? 'Cause it was your idea to go to your hotel room. which is an odd thing for two grown men to go to a hotel room together.
Please take down your pants. Please remove your clothes now. Like, wait, wait, what?
This doesn't seem like mindfulness at all. It's my process, man. Just go with it, you know? And, you know, so we sat there in really what was, you know, an intimate setting, but also kind of emotionally an intimate moment, just because you were sort of helping me delve into something that I had, I think, a mindset for from, you know, from contemplative and centering prayer through my faith, but also as growing up, I'm going to Catholic school, you know, there were several teachers and counselors that sort of in retreats would have us do meditation exercises, but not in mindfulness manner. It was kind of blew me away. So I think I was receptive, as I think I told you that day, to kind of being able to relax, but I didn't know what to do once, other than to calm yourself down. I wasn't focused on the breathing, and I wasn't focused on the multitude of thoughts that were kind of entering into my mind without any provocation, and some with, you know, but to be able to, you know, be able to stop that sort of incessant, you know, bombardment, as I say, of thoughts, emotions, and feelings that were happening without notice. And so that was really, for me, it was clearly an awakening in a lot of ways for me.
And usually that is for me, because I will say that in this experience, that there have been many enlightening moments, right? And one of the first ones was, wow, I'm thinking a lot. It's like, oh, and there's another thought. And it's quite, I don't know if scary is the word, but it was quite revealing, because it was like, well, no wonder we're feeling, you know, overwhelmed sometimes, or when we can get carried away with something, because how, you know, then once we learn to observe it, we can see how quickly like one thought escalates into another. And as you bear witness to it, you can see this domino effect that it has, right? And so, yeah, the shock of, wow, there's a lot going on. Mm-hmm. And the more you look into it, wow, and a lot of it is negative or it's not useful.
Yeah, so some of the early exercises that you had of just being able to, you know, I had my eyes closed and you'd say, just put up your, you know, finger for every time, you know, so we can count them out, right? And don't hold back. And I remember even at that time, in that moment, thinking, you know, does this count? Should I raise my hand again? It was raising your hand. It was raising your hand every time. And you were counting how many times I was raising my hand. And then you delved a little bit further into like, okay, so how many, and then how many of those were negative? And then you, you know, did a real, you know, kind of a deeper dive analysis of, you know, telling me what the, you know, describing for me what the thoughts or emotions or feelings were, and then, you know, kind of disseminated that information, did the analysis on kind of what that looked like, just for, you know, my own understanding. But you're absolutely right, it was more like, gosh, look at how much is going on in such a short period of time. Those were 3-minute mindfulness meditations at the time. We did 3 minutes.
And what, I guess, encouraged me more to continue, you know, engaging and, you know, helping with this was the fact that you were doing the meditations. Because a lot of times you can say, yeah, I want to do this, tell me about mindfulness, but I don't want to do the homework, or, you know, I'm not going to put in the hours. But you were doing it, and you very quickly started to apply it throughout the day. So, you know, and that's when I was like, wow, that really kind of shocked me, because the speed in which you progress to, yep, I'm getting putting in the formal practice, but now I'm applying it in the day when there's such situations arising, I'm like, there is some mindfulness going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's that was the biggest thing for me. It's helped me, you know, to transform in a way that it colors everything else, you know, in my life. Without it, I notice when I don't do my practice, or if it's a morning where I haven't done it, like sometimes on the weekends, but I'm faithfully, you know, doing it as part of the thing I have to do before I go to work, right? And it's 10 minutes a day, and I could see, you know, that carving out that time in the morning is a good start. The challenge is remembering remembering to use it as a practice, not only to do once a day, but to use it in the moment, right? When you're feeling emotions arise. Like, for instance, you know, full disclosure, I was at a point in my life when I would, right before I started working with you and having to really be aware of this, where anger was, you know, kind of anger and frustration were coming to the, you know, coming to a head. You know, people often say it's like, you know, just below the surface. It's nowhere near the surface now. I do, and I have, you and I have been in engaged in confrontation maybe once or twice, and it was, it just happened so fast because there was fear, there was doubt, there was, you know, upset what had happened at work, and all of a sudden anger comes out, and you're like, I didn't even see that coming, right? And so how do you observe it happening before it kind of builds up and blows up, do you sort of say, okay, let's, you know, let me just get back to the breath? Because to me, that's the best practice of all, is that I think I've mentioned this to you several times, is that it's the path that's so important, that the practice and just try to stay on the path. What I was suggesting was it's the path that's so important, and I keep coming back to the path, and part of being okay with the practice is being an observer, and being able to early on observe when things are kind of spinning out, and being able to, okay, to recognize it and come back to it without any judgment at all. Because I think when we practice and try to do anything, there's a tendency to not enjoy the process, or to also kind of beat ourselves up a little bit about it, like, gosh, you know, I tried to do practice today, I was really distracted. And I, rather than counting distractions and how many times you did it, you know, where it went wrong, it's just like, yeah, I recognize it. I went back to the breath. It wasn't the best mindfulness practice of the day, but I did it every day, right? And some days are great. Some days you're like, okay, you know, I was really kind of distracted today and my mind was wandering. You know, in some ways, I play a lot of golf, and I was with a golf coach recently who talks a lot about one of the challenges with the way that, and as you know, golf's very much a mental game. It is in any sport is a mental game. And if you focus on the things you do wrong, you're going to continue to do them wrong. If you say, you know, when you get done with a round or you get done with a hole, and you're like, and you focus on all the areas that it went wrong, it really doesn't, it forces you to not improve or focus on where it went right. So that when it goes right, it should feel kind of naturally, right? So the example would be, I tend to pull the ball left off the tee, and I'd say, I don't want to go left would be my pre-swing thought, versus stay right, you know, just stay, you know, pick a spot and be like, yep, okay, I'm gonna stay right. See how the difference was negative versus positive, right? And sometimes, and I really believe that we have the ability to, in our minds, sort of, that's just a small example. We create for ourselves, we borrow trouble, we create for ourselves, you know, the anxiousness and expectation of something going wrong. And often it will, you know. I think there's great power in through mindfulness and sort of catching ourselves, because that's, I think, is the real key for me, is like catching myself in the moment to be able to take a breath and not fall prey to the emotionality, not fall prey to, you know, the negativity, and really just, you know, do the simplest, most, you know, base thing of like catching ourselves literally and stopping for a moment and remembering to go back to the breath.
Yeah. Because don't forget that whether you practice mindfulness or not, those thoughts don't stop coming. But it's with, you know, oh, there you are again. Oh, there you are again. It's like, oh, there you are. And so instead of, you know, how he said, oh, there you are, you bastard. You know, it's like that kind of, it's like, I see you trying to sneak in there, but it's okay. Now with a bit of compassion, even to ourselves and to the thought itself, understand that we are going to frequently have negative thoughts, but don't be surprised when they come. And when you do notice them, and A, we want to notice them as soon as we can, right? Before they start escalating and before they start triggering off others. But when they do arise, it's to change our perception and our relationship to it, and how before we used to always have this reaction to it. Whereas now we could say, oh, you know, as if it were just background noise, or if it's, you know, that like the postman driving past or riding past on his bike in the morning to notice it. Because if we don't, we'll very quickly fall back into those old habits where that thought will trigger something else, that triggers something else. And very quickly, it's just, you know, that old, that, you know, that what we've engraved, we've carved in, we've etched in in that pathway. It's like, you know, no wonder we keep falling into it, because it's something, you know, that 10,000 hours, we've done that and then some on it. So to retrain the mind will take practice.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. Your combination of that daily practice with the now applying it when it matters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's really the thing that, you know, will help me to differentiate is to, you know, kind of remember. I think that's true of a lot of people, because you're absolutely right. Yeah. I think you get so ingrained. You know, a good example would be someone who's very faithful in their life and goes to church and they practice their faith. But when things really go bad, it's the last thing that they turn to. It's like the last, you know, they don't think of, you know, because they have screwed something up or they made a mistake or that, you know, something devastating has happened in their life. They don't turn to the thing that normally would be the thing that sustains them. And so I, you know, I'm always very cognizant of that, because as it relates to mindful practices, it's part of a whole cadre of things that I do as part of routine, but it's really the foundational piece. And it very much matches up to prayer and mindfulness for me are kind of very tightly connected. But it's embracing our inabilities and embracing the times when we don't do it right, not to get overly, you know, pulled down by it, but just observing it and noticing it and calling it for what it is, so that I think we had this conversation. I talked to my daughter a lot about this, is that we oftentimes will say, I'm sad, I'm anxious, I'm tired, I'm something. We are not those things. Those are just feelings, either bodily or mentally, that we're feeling in the moment. And we're more than that. And too often people just, I think in our country, maybe this is beyond just the United States, but certainly it's kind of pandemic here too, in terms of not just the global pandemic around COVID, but the idea that we're just so want to hold on to, I'm depressed, or I've got this, or I've got that. And we are so much more complex than that. It's not just that. And those could be the feelings that we're feeling.
Exactly.
That they're greater than that.
And it, you know, you are not the tiredness. You are the witness to that. You know, I am, you know, you are not angry. You're merely experiencing the sensations of anger. Mm-hmm. And then when that becomes not just theory, but actual practice, it's like, oh, well, what does that actually even mean? When, if I'm not my anger, then it's so paradigm shifting, because then, well, then I'm not my sadness and I'm not my, you know, that. And it's like, well, in a way, yeah, it's a, you know, we're creating these reactions and these responses to it. And so we feel that we are so intertwined, this ego that, you know, I am the sadness and I am the anger. And then so when you combine that with the thought, because we are not the thought either. And that's prime, that, you know, that's one of the key takeaways, is that you are not your thoughts. And you gather that yourself by witnessing so many. And it's like, wow, they're so random. Some of them are really mean, or some of them are, and it's just this endless amount of, it's almost just jargon a lot of the time.
Yeah. And you identify it. It's so closely tied to your identity.
Yeah.
You know, that it's really hard to let it go. It's hard to let that go because it closely ties to your past.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a reminiscent guy. I reminisce a lot. I'm a nostalgic guy, I should say. I reminisce about the past a lot. I mean, I lost my parents when I was very young. And a lot of what shaped me is because of that experience. But, you know, it's interesting that a person like me who kind of, you know, waxes nostalgically about his past, you know, there's a danger to stay there, because some things in the past are just that. They're just there. And it's great to remember them. Mm-hmm. But it also is, you know, there's not a lot we can do about those things that have happened in the past. We can acknowledge what's happened, whether good, bad, or otherwise. But the, you know, the transformation sort of takes place, I think, for us as human beings is to not live there, right?
Yeah.
And then when you see the opposite of, you know, I see it a lot in my young children who are, you know, they're not young anymore, but, you know, 23 and 27, where they get so spun out about future events and future things, and the anxiety that awaits them, again, borrowing trouble, but also, you know, inviting in the kind of what we talked about, you and I, about that sort of that negative and how it impacts those negative feelings and that anxiety impacts your health, you know, not just your mental health, but it can impact you physically, because we don't know what the outcomes are. You know, we can get really spun out of our in our minds about a future forecast call on a Friday where a lot of people are going to be involved in what could happen. And I'm here to tell you that because of you and because I work with you, and mindfulness practice has helped me to just be in the moment. And I try hard. I don't always do it well, but I try hard not to get too far out ahead of myself. And that's such a gift. And I'm so grateful that you shared that with me. So it really means a lot.
So if you were to describe this to a mate, to a friend, and this, you know, they were, you explained to them about mindfulness and you were trying to explain the benefits, you know, how, you know, for you, what are the benefits for mindfulness for you?
Yeah. So for me, there's numerous benefits in the sense that, you know, I kind of find, you know, when I was really struggling, I was actually praying for peace of mind. And one of the benefits is peace of mind that mindfulness brings, because, you know, it's a sense of kind of where I am right now in the here and now, you know, with both feet on the ground and sort of moving through the day, really aware of kind of what's happening. Now, you know, it's a calming peace of mind sensation that through the practice daily really gets me right-minded. It doesn't prevent me from spinning out during the moments of anxiety or, you know, pressure or stress. That's the practice that I feel like is my next, the thing that I really want to get better at and improve on at. But it's also helped me in the benefits that it's helped me grow closer to my family, to my kids. I'm more present to them than I ever have been for a lot of reasons, but, you know, I can not only empathize and be compassionate with kind of what they're going through, but I actually have something in my toolkit to offer to them. So for my 23-year-old daughter, who is wonderful and beautiful in so many ways, but struggles a lot with anxiety and gets overwhelmed by it, she gets a daily mindfulness reflection from me every day. You know, after I'm done,
beautiful, yeah.
I use some of the, you know, some of the things and the thoughts and what I'm feeling right when it's done and share that with her sort of as a mantra, so that she, it's a way for me to connect with her, but it's also kind of encouraging her that, like, you know, Kenzie, you know, emotions come and go, right? And for you and I and everybody on this planet, you know, the idea is, you know, the simplest thing that we do every moment is take a breath. And if we just kind of take a chance to focus on, she's, I have too many thoughts going on. I'm like, I get it. That's the whole point.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's the 100% of the point. It's not because you don't have thoughts, because you do. It's just that your thoughts don't define you, and your thoughts don't control you. You have an ability to step back and not necessarily control the thoughts coming in, but at least observe them to such a way where you're controlling your mind and ability to kind of stay focused.
You know, where does the breath come from? Where does it start? You know, for sometimes it's a focus. For me, it's at the abdomen and the gut, right? Because it's like where it begins. You know, sometimes it's through the nose, you know, coming in. You know, it's just a lot of different triggers to just really kind of get granular about the breath beginning and ending, each one, right? So there's kind of like the ocean waves, right? The ocean waves flow in, you know, as our breath flows in. And there's a moment which the wave kind of sets, you know, on the shore, and then it flows back. And that's kind of the out breath. So that's an image I use a lot when I think about preparing for what it means to sort of be mindful on breathing. So those are benefits. So better relationships with the people in my life that mean a lot.
That's a massive one. Yeah.
Yeah. That's huge. And also, you know, this is something that gets used a lot. I think I mentioned this to you. There's one of the many favorite theologians that I follow, talks about the wounded healer concept, that the wounded healer is more apt to, if he's been, he or she's been wounded, they're more apt to be able to heal those that are also wounded. So in a battlefield scenario, if I've been shot, I'm going to be the first one to go over to somebody else who's also been shot to help them, versus someone who's just trying to make it through the battle without ever having to stop, right, and survive. So they have no ability to kind of know that empathy that comes with knowing what it's like to lay in in a position. So when you think about that, that's kind of my, at the core of what my belief system is and kind of how I practice, is that acknowledging our wounds is really a big part of this, right? That by acknowledging our own wounds, we become better at helping others who are wounded. When we don't acknowledge our wounds, it becomes a little bit more of a challenge to do that, because then we're sort of resisting change. We're resisting the things that we can't control.
Yeah. And that's why compassion is one of the benefits that is, you know, that is described a lot and, you know, proven as one of the benefits to mindfulness, because, you know, people find it in different mediums, but this idea of better relationships with the empathy, and it is, you know, almost a necessary step along this way. Mm-hmm. You know, especially the idea that if I'm having all these negative thoughts and it's really overwhelming and I'm doing okay with it, you know, there must be many people that, you know, their baseline is they wake up and it's not okay. And it's not, oh yeah, I have a negative thought, okay, then in a minute it's gone. It's like, well, it just recycles all day long. And it's, you know, we said negative thoughts produces these chemicals in your body that when you're microdosing yourself nonstop, it can be, you know, very bad physically and just mentally. It's not a pleasant space to be in. And that's why when we hear of mental illness, we hear of anxiety, depression, suicide, and, you know, the NHS now, the biggest expense is on mental health care, because that's where there is the biggest issue.
Yeah, I just buried my former brother-in-law. We went to his funeral on Saturday, and he struggled with mental illness for a big part of his life, most specifically in the last 13 years. And he, you know, bipolar, anxiety, depression, a lot of different things. And he ended up dying of a disease that was very rare. It's called Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease disorder. It's a prion protein in your brain that's often referred to as mad cow in human beings. It's very rare, extremely rare. But what's interesting about saying that is that there's two observations. One is that Chris struggled with this for a lot of his life, but you don't know where, like, the disorder and where the prion and the protein from the negative, you know, kind of got kicked off in his brain, and where that picked up from what was already a difficult mental illness scenario. And then, you know, the other thought was that, you know, when he was laying there and I went to see him in the hospital, he was pretty comatose on a lot of morphine and stuff, but I was noticing his breathing, you know, because he wasn't there. I mean, he was kind of gone. He could hear us, maybe, but his sensations, he'd lost, you know, sort of control of the extremities and all that stuff. Pretty awful, but the idea was that I noticed that he, you know, it's the most natural thing that we do is breathe, you know. And I know that Chris fought hard to try to get a handle on it. And the insidious part of that is that, you know, there's all kinds of chemical ways that people try to help you get a handle on these mental illnesses. But, you know, we want people to get better. And if you have a physical ailment, you take this, you do that, and you see the results and you get better, right? You get better from the flu, or you get better from, and if you're a diabetic, you have to, you know, take insulin, and you have to do these steps, and then when you do, you're not going to have as many episodes. With mental illness, it sort of comes from nowhere, and you want the people that you love to get better, and you can't love them back into being healthy mentally. And so that's really the sad part. But I think a guy like Chris, or, you know, anyone else who's out there listening, it's, you know, maybe the simplest solution is not a chemical one. It's really, you know, the ability to calm our minds, to not keep resisting the things we can't change, but accept, even if it is accepting my depression, accepting my anxiety, accepting the fact that I have very highs and lows, and finding a way to, within that acceptance, to breathe and to really practice the mindfulness techniques, because I think build up little by little, as you and I talk about, little by little, day by day, moment by moment. And for some people in mental illness or addictions, it is a moment by moment. Like I'm struggling in this moment and I can't stop. Like my daughter's struggling with that now. I can't stop to do this. Well, sometimes it is just a minute or 30 seconds, you know, and at 30 seconds builds to a minute, that builds to 3 minutes, that builds to 10 minutes a day. And all of a sudden we got something, right? Mm-hmm. And I would love to have seen, you know, if it would have changed anything for Chris or not, but I would have loved for to have been able to share that with him in the same way that I'm sharing it with Mackenzie every day.
Beautiful.
Awesome.
So, well, thanks again for sharing, Sean. No, much appreciated. Yeah, we've been meaning to do this for a long time now, but, you know, we said if we'd recorded some of our conversations, you know, we could have equally have shared those as well, you know, because...
Yeah, I think so too. I would tell you that several people in those bad moments, difficult days, you being one of them, said this very simple phrase. It changed the world for me. I can remember the day you said it. I remember several others. And it was just awkward. It was strange to me that it happened all in the short period of time when I was really at my lowest moment. Someone said, and you said it, you're a good man. So you're a good man had a huge, deep impact on me. And I will tell you as we close out, thank you, Guy. I appreciate all you've given me. I'm grateful for the friendship, but also for this unique gift of mindfulness. And you're a good man.
Yeah, and it's been both ways, mate. I've learned in this, in helping each other, we learn ourselves, you know, 100%. So, all right, brother, enjoy the rest of the weekend and we'll chat Monday.
You too. All right, sounds good.
All right, back to work on Monday. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
All right, take care. All right, bye-bye.